This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're going to talk about in this episode include...
Other eras for fall of Delta Green.
Animal attack forensics.
Pruning our libraries.
And pilots dropping ticks.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady, Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys, and Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the beautiful shag-carpeted interior of our retro gaming den, and the GM screen composed from the Peter Frampton Coming Alive double album tell us that we're once more in proximity to the gaming hut. And this time around, beloved Patreon backer Hyperlexic wants to know the following. What about moving Fall of Delta Green to other time periods? Obviously, it breaks canon, but my group actually doesn't know that. And I was thinking that Iraq, too, has more current resonance for Imperial overreach. If Ken was going to move Fall of Delta Green to the Second Iraq War for a group that doesn't really know Delta Green canon, what are some things you would think about?
Well, the first thing I would think about is... I'd think about the opposite ends of this question. So in Delta Green canon, Delta Green is set up after the raid on Innsmouth. A program begins looking into it. They get then tasked to fight the occult powers of the Axis. And then after the Roswell crash, they use that to spin themselves up into a global anomaly hunting secret agency. And then they leave the sort of technological aspects to their partners in crime, Majestic 12, which turns out to be a bad idea for other reasons. But they then continue to exert America's imperial will against the unnatural until they overreach in Cambodia in a classic operation, Operation Obsidian, which goes so wrong that it wakes up the North Vietnamese army. And so when we invade Cambodia later that year in 1970, the mission goes terribly and Delta Green is blamed for it and is disbanded. So that's the hubris and overreach pattern. Now, in the Iraq War, plenty of stuff went wrong, but it didn't go invasion of Cambodia wrong. So you need to figure out on the far end, are we heading for a Delta Green crash, a sort of fiasco that is so enormous that it shuts down the program? Because I think that if you look at the history of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, no fiasco shuts down any programs.
Right. Iraq, too, is enormously damaging to the Iraqi people because it touched off civil wars and then led to the rise of ISIS. But that none of those things concerned anybody back home. That was, right, it was much easier just to write that off of everybody's list of concerns.
Exactly, as collateral damage. And so the notion is that you have to have some Operation Obsidian for your imperial overreach, but I suppose what you could do is you could say that the Delta Green in Iraq went into Syria in an unauthorized hunt that they said was they were hunting, you know, insurgents across the border into Syria, which occasionally we sort of did, and that something that they did caused the Syrian civil war, that they, you know, broke up a situation that was necessary for the Syrian government to remain modestly stable. And then the Syrian civil war is what they blamed on Delta Green. And in a upsurge of do-gooder energy, the Obama administration shuts down Delta Green. And so then you have your mythology basically intact. And Syria is a gigantic catastrophe, maybe not a Cambodia big, but a pretty big catastrophe. So that I think works. Then the other thing is you have to ask the question is, are we extending the Delta Green Majestic rivalry through the Reagan administration? I mean, Delta Green canon, Delta Green is now illegal. They're a secret conspiracy that does stuff. But in our version, they are, you know, part of the Reagan doctrine. They're out there in Afghanistan doing stuff with the Mujahideen. They're out there in, you know, Angola and El Salvador and wherever else. They're part of the American imperial footprint at the end of the Cold War. And then the end of the Cold War lets Majestic 12, you know, spin off a bunch of its research into commercial applications and, you know, creates the internet that works so well for us all today. But the Delta Green continues as a sort of increasingly fat and happy military intelligence sector bureaucracy, and perhaps gets a little lazy and soft, much like our military intelligence bureaucracy did after the end of the Cold War. And so you have to decide, how much of that backstory do I want to lumber my campaign with? Does my Delta Green work if it is the bloated version of the Defense Intelligence Agency or the CIA even, rather than a scrappy team of guys in Eisenhower jackets fighting Dagon? And that is another question that you have to ask. And maybe you can have Delta Green, as since it's part of the military, it gets reformatted in the same way that the Delta Force and the Special Forces generally did, that it keeps going into the Special Forces reorgs, which did in fact sort of roil the world of the Special Forces over and over. And because every president wants something they can do cheap and off the media. And that's why presidents are always interfering with the Special Forces. You could say that maybe Delta Green is part of that. So with that caveat, setting a Delta Green game in, you know, the Iraq war period, 2003 through 2011, is certainly, you know, it's got a lot of, as Hyperlexic says, current resonance. There's lots of stuff you can do. I think you might want to make sure that if you have any veterans of that campaign in your game group, that you talk it over with them and say, how fast and loose can we play with this stuff? But there's any number of genuine tragedies, actual atrocities, and then monstrously evil behavior by our foes, any of which can be given a Cthulhoid gloss if that charges you up. Or it can be the way that Arc Green basically treats Delta Green, as adjacent to but not deeply involved in the era's other sins and atrocities. So you're not making Agent Orange to kill Shub Niggurath. You're just going in under cover of Agent Orange to do something else magical, and that's sort of the approach. And again, this is something you can sort of make the cocktail as strong as you like it in play.
Right, because the challenge is not envisioning a second Gulf War where the forces of Cthulhu and the mythos are active, but imagining an equivalent of the Church Committee during the Global War on Terror. And right. So if you want to sort of follow the vibe of the actual history rather than trying to back project a bigger scandal, it might just be that, you know, the Obama administration, rather than there being a big scandal that causes them to sideline Delta Green, they just go, well, could we do this in a subtler way? These places that you need us to hit, can't we do those with drones? And so you could have a situation where, yes, there still is an equivalent of Delta Green, but that's, you know, guys in prefab mobile homes controlling drones on the other side of the world and having them blow up different sites and rituals. And yeah, sure, sometimes you blow up some cultists and stuff, but, you know, we're just going to do this low risk thing that we're not going to risk any possible blowback from. So it could, instead of a big scandal, it could be, you know, a budget cut that, we'll just move all this money over to our, you know, anti-Yogg-Sothoth drone strike program. But you know, all our field guys, we're just going to cut you loose. So if you want to, you know, sit in a chair for 6 hours a day and look for cultists to blow up, that's great. But otherwise, you know, this other stuff, that's old hat. That's the path talking there. We're going to do things the easy way. And therefore, that's what causes Delta Green to have to go and reconstitute itself secretly, because they know you still need boots on the ground when you're dealing with, you know, deep ones and flying polyps and all of those things. You can't always get them with drone strikes, because guess what? Sometimes they can tell they're being watched and cast their consciousness backwards into the drone jockeys back home in the big parking lot in Arizona that they all work from.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, is a way to sort of get classic Delta Green energy into the Obama administration and maybe early Trump era, and even down to now, potentially, although the willingness of the American government to send special forces in to get into trouble maybe means that Delta Green also is being stood back up. But for the fall era, when you have, you know, the best helicopter gunships and artillery and fighter planes and everything else backing up your play, which is sort of a bit of the energy of fall of Delta Green over conventional Delta Green. Another thing that you want to look at is the degree to which decisions made on the ground are being called in Washington, that you get inside of the location, you send the intel, you know, through your video back to the spotter plane sends it back to the base sends it back to the Pentagon. You're waiting maybe hours before you get the go sign. And somewhere in that loop, I think there's a lot of pregnant opportunity for play, because either the Delta Green guy at the Pentagon is making a bunch of decisions without all the facts, because it's about, as you say, being on the ground and feeling the energy, or there's people who are joggling his elbow while he's trying to take out this Yog-Sothoth cult, and they're like, no, that's too close to the main highway. There's going to be too many witnesses.
It's the global war on terror, not the cosmic war on terror.
Exactly. Do something else. You know, do it smaller, do it simpler, do it without those weapons, do it with these weapons. So the bureaucratic and informational struggle becomes a part of the problem. And then the information loop itself is, of course, a classic place for unnatural contamination to seep into. If you've got a internet capable Delta Green, you've got internet capable foes. There are, you know, Nyarlathotepist egregores in the internet, rough beast AIs waiting to be born, that kind of thing. And so anything you send on a computer back to the Pentagon, there's a chance that you're breaking OPSEC. There's a chance that you're informing Nyarlathotep. And so, like in Fall of Delta Green, where at some point you say, you know what, I'm not going to bother anyone with this, I'm just going to do it with satchel charges, you start doing that in Iraq Fall of Delta Green, and then foreshadowing the growth of the eventual conspiracy, as you say.
Well, now that we're foreshadowing an eventual conspiracy, it's time for us to foreshadow an exciting commercial and an exciting segment on the other side of it.
In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Maryshire, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Yeah, can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. But weren't we concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Maryshire Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable,
but still murdery,
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked, remember you're supposed to be solving a case, gather some more clues, question more eccentric locals,
possibly chase a swan or something,
and slowly piece together the truth.
Coming soon to Backer Kit from Pelgrane Press.
Type Backer Kit and Marisher into your favorite search engine to find the launch page.
The bubbling of the beakers, the snapping of the Van de Graaff generators, and the horrendous marks on the flesh of the cadaver tell us that we're once more having fun with science. And I guess in this segment, we're going to ask you with one hand to keep in mind everything we said about forensic science being bunk, but have fun with the notion that animal forensic or attack forensics is not bunk. And this is the science of what animal did that to you. And this is, of course, not just good for, you know, you out in the woods and you find a body, but also if you're a Trail of Cthulhu or Night's Black Agents Game Master, here's some new ways to mutilate a corpse. So right. Robin,
or more specifically, like the classic scene in a horror thing is the coroner or the one of the cops on the scenes goes, this ain't no animal mauling. And so that raises the question, well, what is an animal mauling? So first right. of all, if it is not already apparent, this segment will contain injury details. So if that's a thing you don't want to hear about, I'll have a few anodyne sentences while you scrub ahead. And so this segment is inspired by the initial chapters of Mary Roach's book, Fuzz, which is all about different conflicts between nature and people. And of course, the clearest conflict between animals and people is when, first of all, people attack animals way more often than the other way around. We're much more of a hazard to each other and to all nature and all animal life than animals are to us. And so these are, by their very nature, rare events. But as we pointed out, if you're doing a Monster of the Week episode, you have to be able to distinguish the horrible things that have happened. You got to rule out a bear. And you mentioned our previous segment on how forensics is largely unreliable. And I was thinking of, you know, beginning to get to grips with this material, I was thinking that, oh, well, but it's kind of okay in this case because it's not like they're trying to exonerate individual bears, but they are. They are trying to exonerate actual bears. Quite often, they will capture three bears after a fatal bear attack, and they'll do a DNA test to find which of them needs to be disposed of, which is the way in North America, and which are allowed to go about their business and are innocent bears. And mostly, this pertains to the reliable part of forensic science, the DNA, and also, you know, forensic anthropology of study of actual bodies and what happens to them. And so there's a little bit of like blood spatter and stuff in there, but like, you know, the bears aren't shooting us with guns and then we're not framing them by claiming ballistics. It's more specific than it really is.
That's why cops in the Northwest have a drop bear.
Exactly.
They just leave at the scene and say, oh no, that guy was killed by a bear.
Right. Well, you can only drop a bear in circumstances where the face has been heavily damaged because bears mostly attack one another. They don't attack people. And when they fight by biting each other. They're omnivores, so they're not optimized for killing, but they have some powerful bite action. And so a severely damaged face is evidence of a bear bite.
They're Onok, not Modok.
Yes. Cougars, and I think by extension other big cats, are optimized to feed on deer. Deer are basically in the ecosystem very big mice. Lots of creatures feed on them. And cougars jump on the muscular neck of the deer. And so in the very rare situations where they are biting a human, they will try to come up from behind and bite you from behind. But we do not have the big muscular tasty necks that a deer does. And so the cat's teeth will hit bone faster and slide off. One way to show that someone has been attacked by a monster and not an animal is that animals will rarely eat any part of a person that is clothed. Clothing kind of, it turns out, baffles them. So if they run into an unclothed person, They will do what predators do to other animals, which is they'll tear open the abdomen to get at the internal organs. But they essentially never do that with clothed people. So that is, I guess, one advantage of having evolved to the point where we wear clothing. Animals are scavengers. Almost any animal will scavenge. A deer will eat a mouse even. And so one thing that you will need to determine as part of your investigation is whether, in fact, the person who's been snacked upon by an animal was killed by that animal. So, for example, there have been cases where, say, somebody goes off into the woods, has an overdose or just a fatal medical emergency, and they then might become carrion for a bear or a big cat. And the people who do attack forensics want to distinguish whether that bear or big cat needs to be hunted and put down, or, you know, if the person was dead already, you know, I think fair enough is the feeling on that. Another interesting detail is that cougars and bears will lightly bury a body. Obviously, they, you know, it's going to be a very shallow grave. They're just going to throw some dirt and leaves on top of it because they want to come back for later, right? It's their equivalent of, you know, storing it in the fridge. That can become a hazard if you come upon the body that they consider to be theirs, their food source, and may then attack the people interfering with the body. So that, I think, can be the basis for an interesting scene. And I think that's one where you can substitute your monster, right? Because I think all sorts of monsters that are essentially apex predators would do exactly the same thing. They wouldn't leave the body on the site. They'd drag it off for later feasting. So that might mean if there's a lot of drag marks that the Shoggoth or, you know, the lycanthrope or whatever it is has pulled the body somewhere else, that can be an indication to the person with skill in the party that you want to tread very carefully because you're basically headed into the larder of the monster.
I like the idea of finding a body that's lightly buried and then finding another body right next to it that's lightly buried and then finding another body next to that one that's lightly buried as the creature is discovered. If I just leave my fridge door open, it keeps attracting more meat. This is amazing.
Yeah, it's an Escher loop of fatal animal attacks. Wolf attacks are too rare to even study, despite the extreme terror with which people in the medieval era viewed wolves. We do not have enough information on what a fatal wolf attack would look like.
I feel like maybe wolf attacks were less rare in the medieval era before guns
but there were no lights. Nobody wrote down in detail what they were, so they remain a mystery. The Mary Roach book focuses she mostly on North American animals, although she does go to an area in India where the leopards there just prey on people normally, which is quite unusual for leopards, but they've developed a taste for people, and she covers all the sort of social aspects of the problem there because in India, the idea is that animals are sacred. Every animal has a god associated with them. And so on a broad level, people don't want to see the animals who, even the ones who kill people, killed. But that's the broad popular view. And you feel quite differently, if it was a member of your family.
Yeah, the local village has a different vote.
Yes. So the most terrifying animal attack in terms of its brutality, of course, is from our closest relative on the list, and that would be the chimpanzee. In the wild, they murder one another, and keeping them in captivity does not improve their mood any as they age. So famously, they will attack in a horrible blitz attack pattern, and in a lot of cases, they will bite off your hands, which renders you unable to attack back, and then rip off your face or rip off other protruding body parts. So that is the most horrible thing, I think, on the list, the most vivid thing on the list. And also, chimps understand tactics. And for example, when they fight each other in the wild, they will work to have higher ground and attack by pouncing. When an elephant intends to kill you, and in places where elephants and people live side by side, it is not uncommon for an elephant to want to kill. It will pull you apart as if you're like a banana tree that it's stripping bark off of. So that's also quite a horrible way to go. And a distinguishing factor there is to determine whether it is intended to kill you, in which case it has torn you apart, or just stepped on your head by accident.
It's on its way somewhere else and you were in the way.
Yes. And a very large percentage of fatal elephant incidents occur, like with 33% in India, when drunk people provoke them. So I think if you're taking away...
I think that's the same number for human-on-human crimes most places.
That is also a big element in humans killing each other, exactly. And of the herbivores, the hippo, of course, is the one you'd least want to mess with. You'll wind up with massive crushing trauma, often coupled with drowning. So you especially don't want to fight a giant tusked herbivore that can pull you into the water and drown you. Alligators go about their, again, relatively rare human attacks the same way. So a body will have sharp bite trauma combined with drowning quite often. Domestic pigs famously actually kill a lot more people than you might think. And that's often, again, when people make mistakes with very large pigs on farms, that happens. And because they're so heavy, there'll be crushing damage as well as biting damage. And it can obscure sort of the sequence of injury. So in your scenario where it might be a monster, it might be a pig, that is where sort of a vague generalized attack where it's like, well, this could be a pig. I don't know. Wild pigs come into contact with us a lot less frequently. They're not in pens, so they have the opportunity to run away from us. But they will throw in some goring in a very rare wild pig attack. And of course,
they have the big tusks that we've mostly bred out of pigs.
And I guess finally, we should talk about Australian animals. The wombat is a tripping hazard. You can trip over that, fall, and hit your head in a rock. So the wombat will make sure that it trips you near a rock. And that's very hard to detect. People just think they fell and hit a rock. And worst of all, the kangaroo, it will grab your mouth with its little hand and hold it open. And then with its other hand, it will reach into its pouch and get a cyanide pill and stick that in there. So
right.
I think everybody knows how deadly Australian animals are, and that's really the problem with kangaroos.
Well, you know, nature is wonderful that it has evolved the cyanide pill in the kangaroo. That's just,
right.
That's beautiful. You think that the entirely pointless poison spurs of the platypus are a lot, but when you have an animal that keeps a cyanide pill right by its baby,
yeah.
That's how you know that animal is gangsta and will not take any of your crap.
Right. Well, the kangaroo is very charismatic, so it's easy enough for it to go to a pharmacy, you know, get what it needs.
Oh, so you think that it gets so you would be intelligent design kangaroo cyanide pill, not evolution kangaroo cyanide pill.
Well, I don't think the kangaroos make the cyanide. That's ridiculous, Ken.
All right. Well,
this show is based on solid research.
This is fun with science, not fun with pretend science.
Yes, exactly. But before we got to Australia, everything else was real.
Right.
And on that note, let's go to another possibly real segment on the other side of this exciting commercial.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality-shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com.
Keep elephants from stomping this podcast by joining beloved and Patreon backers.
Liz Ansiski.
Robbie Carlton.
James Candelino.
Jesse Lowe.
And the Redacted Files Podcast.
it's time once again to ask Ken and Robin. So let's ask Ken and Robin. Beloved Patreon backer Mike Coleman asks Ken and Robin, saying Ken recently spoke about deaccessioning items from his library, and I think Robin said something similar about his films. What do you do with your purged items? Pass them on to friends and family? eBay? Used media stores? Is Ken storing score credit at the local used bookshop? America wants to know, or at least Mike Coleman wants to know. So what's the answer, Robin? Are you building up points at whatever they have that is a succeeded Blockbuster in Canada?
So some of the things that we've deaccessioned recently, because we've acquired a 4K player and some discs to put in it, are like the cream of our collection. We're replacing sometimes Blu-rays, but mostly that's just when we have them, we get a whole set of something and already have some Blu-rays, because the rule is mostly like we have to be upgrading from DVD to 4K, not just from Blu-ray to 4K.
Right. Like there's a whole bunch of new Hammers that are coming out in 4K and Blu-ray. And so now the, you know, which Hammer collections do you have that you have to resort through type stuff?
Right. And so, for example, we got a 14 film Hitchcock box. Means a lot of Hitchcocks to give away. We just picked up the Wes Anderson Criterion box. That was our big splurge for the year. So that'll be some more things to give away, including some Blu-rays in that case. So our order of deaccessioning things is, first of all, the friends who come over most often and can most easily pour through the stacks of stuff get first crack. So that means the Tuesday Night Game Group. And so they got their first crack at things. Valerie may put aside some things for family members, but that means waiting until she goes to the nearby city where the rest of the family lives. She did take some stuff to a used store, but these days, and I think books are even worse in this respect now, that the amount of stuff that they think they can sell at a used book/DVD store is a mere fraction of what it was back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And so they're very picky about what they'll buy. You don't really get a lot of money for it. And they won't even, you know, take all the other things off your hands because storage space is expensive too. So ultimately, the final beneficiaries, some people just on the street scored some pretty cool things, including some Like It Hot, for example. So that's a, you know, that's a banger. Toronto is a city where when you have stuff that someone else might want, you can just put it in a bag out on the sidewalk and someone will come by and get it. And that someone might be hopefully a film student who will make great use of these great films, or could just be a hoarder who's going to put it in their house. But we prefer to think the former.
Right.
So that's our deaccessioning experience. We have already pared our books down years and years ago. And when we did that, that was back in the day. Valerie was annoyed, though, at one point. She had some old vintage paperbacks that she couldn't sell, put them out in the street, and then saw them in the store she tried to sell them to at jacked up prices. So someone else did a better job of selling them on the buyer. And Ken, I think your method is the same, right? That you start with finding the friends who need these books.
Yeah. When I have either older versions of the disc to get rid of or more often books that need to go find another home. Yeah. I start with friends, people who come over. There's a big stack on my staircase of books that are waiting to go somewhere. And it's like, yeah, take a look, see what you want. That does not move the stack down an awful lot because most of my friends, I don't want to say they see me as a cautionary example, but they're not in as big a hurry to accumulate a library as they might be.
I think the fact that the books are on the staircase tells them everything they need to know.
Everything they need to know. I don't have the patience or an indigent family member, young family member, to give to eBay. So what I do is I wait, and then when Will Hindmarch has time to drive, we will go out to Half Price Books with the books. And you don't want to look how the sausage is made, but they have the great, great habit of taking the whole box. They will not pick it through. They'll offer you one price for the Half Price box. Maybe it's a good amount. Maybe it's a good bit less than you want. But either way, they're out of your house, which was the point. So I've gotten in the mid-hundreds.
Now, is that the special Kenneth Height deal where they know they're getting quality? Or is that an across-the-board policy?
They don't have an across-the-board policy, or at least the staff changes over enough times. So sometimes, yes, I've brought in stuff and they've said, oh, yeah, that's great. Do you have any more of these older occult books that no one has looked at? Because those always turn over. Other times, rather than hundreds of dollars, which I have gotten for boxes, I have gotten tens of dollars. But, you know, I didn't want them. The whole point and I could take that tens of dollars and I could buy a burrito and everyone's a winner. So yeah, Half Price Books so far has the best policy. I do have a lovely local used bookshop, one of the greats, Powell's, but I would have to physically transport the books about 2/3 of a mile to Powell's. And I don't feel like carrying books to Powell's. I have enough trouble sometimes carrying books away from Powell's. So my goal is to build them up and then have a friend, usually, as I mentioned, beloved friend of the podcast, Will Hindmarch. And we use this as an excuse to go do some gallivanting and noodling in general, but it's always fun to start with a drop off at Half Price.
Right. Now, I do have a DVD that I've tried to get rid of to not great success. And maybe listeners have a tip. It's just, and it's weird. The case is not, is a little melted, I think. And there's, the box art is missing. There's just like a piece of what I think is masking tape, although it's not the kind of masking tape I'm familiar with. And it has what I think of as Japanese characters on it. And when I pick up this disc, I just get an image of a wet ghost coming through the TV screen. And even though it does seem to be a Region 3 DVD, well, first of all, I now have a Region 3 player. So I think I can probably play it. And sometimes I'm tempted to, and other times I will just, you know, leave the DVD on the street. I'll stick it in somebody's little library. I've sold it a couple of times and it sells relatively well, but then it's suddenly back in my apartment. So I'm not really sure what to do about that. So maybe you maybe can have some suggestions, or maybe a listener.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could help, but I got the same problem with this little book that I have. Maybe it's the same thing. There's, I wouldn't call it Japanese characters on it, but I might have the book of your film, which would be hilarious. But it's more, I would say, Chinese or Arabic, and it's like one big glyph on it. It's nicely bound, which is why I got it in the first place, but it was in French, and I don't read French. So it's like, well, you know, I guess that this is a cool little French book of some kind. Looks like it's formatted in a play. Yeah, but now that you sort of have jogged my memory, maybe I will go pop it into the little free library and take it off the shelf down with the Baudelaire and the other French literature. That probably makes sense. I think that some wandering passerby in Hyde Park, you know, would probably be able to use this better than me.
Or if Half Price Books has a whole box policy, you just put it at the bottom of the box.
Yeah, just toss it in. Yeah, if I think of it.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I think we've each solved our own problems, but we are still interested in what others have to suggest on that point. But the biggest suggestion I have is that we listen to this not at all masking taped or weirdly glyphed commercial and then see what waits for us on the other side.
The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. Over the years, we have given many topics a hot, but one topic we have contained by giving it only a corner. However, despite our efforts to contain it, people still engage in pareidolia and weird rumors and paranoia and putting themselves at the center of their own insular universe. And that's where we get the conspiracy corner. And this time around, we're going to look at a particularly colorful new conspiracy. Points for originality, or is it? We'll find out later whether this fits a very old pattern. But this one is sort of a conspiracy theory meeting urban legend, because Ken, all of a sudden, this year, 2026, there are a number of people in my home province of Ontario who are all a Twitter, all agitated, having convinced themselves that pilots are being paid to drop ticks all around my fair, beautiful Summary province. Ken, what's up with this?
This began apparently with someone positioning themselves as a bold whistleblower. I was a pilot. I was paid. I was given boxes of ticks and told to drop them over the farms and fields of Green and Pleasant, Ontario. And I've done it a lot. This is just the first year I've come clean, but it, now that I think about it, I've been doing this for years. I just didn't mention it. Last year, says the guy, they were mostly American dog ticks. This year, it's all deer ticks. This hits TikTok and goes not mega viral, but more viral than you like to see tick nonsense go.
Right. Enough viral to then get into the mainstream press.
Right.
And
exactly.
Spread the meme further.
And there are also stories, apparently, of American farmers finding boxes of ticks left in their fields, whether they fell from Canadian pilots crossing the border or American pilots as part of the same deadly tick program. Who can say? But the speculators who speculate that this is a scheme to spread Lyme disease so as to force people to buy the Pfizer vaccine for Lyme disease. A cunning plan indeed, modular the fact that Pfizer does not have a Lyme disease vaccine yet.
Well, the facts and people who worry about vaccines are infrequently acquainted.
So the Ontario Federation of Agriculture, also the Ontario Federation of Fun Ruining, comes in and gives us some possible bits of this picture that are assembled into the picture of Jesus on the tortilla. Box-like traps are used to catch ticks and other bugs to study them, and someone walking through the woods might have seen them lying around and not know.
So you might be stealing some poor grad student's summer project.
Exactly. And they assure the good farmers of Canada that they don't go onto your land to do it. They only ask permission or do it on public land. So there. The Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources does drop edible rabies vaccine baits to bats by plane. I feel like there has to be a better way to get things to bats than drop them by plane, but I'm not the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources. I might go to a cave and throw them in.
The other part requires going into a scary cave.
Exactly. They're not the Ontario Ministry of Batman. That's a whole different group. And because it wouldn't be a government statement without blaming climate change, they say that, well, Ontario is warmer than it used to be. That means more ticks, especially black-legged ticks that people aren't used to seeing. People aren't used to them, so they're seeing more ticks. That maybe is why we have a new theory of tick airborne dispersal.
Right. And even though that bit, although it does tie into climate change, that's not wrong. We do have more ticks here because they're a warm weather creature and it's getting warmer.
And also human habitat, as it presses out into farther out into the wilderness, you meet more wilderness creatures. That's just the way that works. We've seen this over and over and over with all manner of things.
Yes, and the wilderness creatures come into the cities. So
yes,
that's
exactly
also a concern.
And if cities have large areas of green space, or specifically wet green space, well, that's tick country. Speaking of idiots and ticks, there are people whose business card says bioethicist, but should say dumbass, that are stoking the next conspiracy theory. We're ahead by one now. Two bioethics professors at Western Michigan University speculated in a 2025 paper called Beneficial Blood Sucking that spreading the Lone Star tick, which causes alpha-gal syndrome, a potentially fatal allergy to red meat and dairy, could be a virtuous act. Like, if you believe that killing animals is wrong, shouldn't you be spreading deadly ticks? Or if you believe that cattle growth is contributing to global warming, shouldn't you be spreading deadly ticks? The answer, by the way, is no, but I'm not a bioethicist, so it should be no with an exclamation point, I guess.
Yes. At least this is just notional tick spreading. This is just floating the idea and enraging people.
The New York University bioethicist Matthew Lau has been proposing various sorts of human engineering, some of them fun, some of them idiotic and not fun, such as involuntary AGS infection, alpha-gal syndrome infection, to combat climate change. And he's been proposing this specific vector of tick spreading since at least 2016 when he did it in a TED talk. Later conspiracy people who have, of course, glommed onto this have said that he did it at the World Economic Forum. I have not dived into his funding or every public appearance by Matthew Lau, but he deserves it if people have assumed he's been at the World Economic Forum. PETA, of course, can't find any idea so bad they can't put it on a billboard. They proposed it as an April Fool's joke in 2013. and 2018, and it has already inspired conspiracy theories about the Gates Foundation's tick research program. And if your dumb conspiracy theory is getting in the way of vital tick eradication policy, then I am mad at everyone, but I'm especially mad at bioethicists who literally their whole job is to know better. And they can't do their job. So,
yes.
You know.
Well, they are the chief bioethicist for Spectre, so.
If they are lynched by angry tick paranoiacs, everyone will deserve what happens to them, is my point.
Right. And, of course, this is powerful, not just because it's a vivid image, and a guy was claiming that he had done it anonymously, mm-hmm. of course. But this essentially reskins an archaic traditional connection that spans all sorts of cultures between the idea that witches or sorcerers, or sometimes, yes, even vampires, are spreading vermin and or disease. So this takes the supernaturalism out of it, but it gives the job to pilots in planes, because although that's entirely technological, it's still more magical in a way.
Right.
If the guy said, yeah, I get hired to go around in a truck, leaving boxes of ticks, which I think we both sort of hinted at would be, if you're engaged in, you know, the Spectre tick distribution program, a truck would be the more economical way to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't even have to go into a scary cave as you do with bats.
Right.
But that does make it something that comes from above. So that resonates then with all chemtrails, longstanding conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you alternate on Tuesdays is tick day, then the rest of the day it's chemtrail day. That's how
exactly. It's like a bonus program. You get points if you combine them. And of course, there is the postmodern contagion effect going on. This is a contagion effect about a contagion effect insofar as that's what social media runs on now. And, you know, this one guy who I kind of think is a prankster has created this sort of grist that, of course, all sorts of paranoid, conspiracy-minded folks would jump on and propagate. And, you know, we're definitely far past the point where the question that I used to have on consulting a cultist, which is, believer or charlatan, has completely muddied that you can be merely seeking attention and believe none of this, yet still spread it and receive what you're looking for. Or you can, in fact, be believing the thing that you just made up in your own head 30 seconds ago as you sit in your car doing a TikTok thing.
As Aristotle reminds us, the mask becomes the face. If you pretend to believe in conspiracies because you're an ironic edgelord, eventually you start believing in conspiracies because that's what happens to people who rewire their brain that way. You have to work very hard to do a bisociation job the way that I do professionally. Don't do this at home, kids.
Yes. So to turn evil into good, we could turn this into a number of scenario hooks, the most obvious of which is that in fact, as ticks go, they're relatively benign ticks being dropped by these pilots because this is a pilot program, so to speak, to test the coming dropping of the alien insects, who will be the ultimate invasive species and engage in whatever form of conquest or environmental sabotage or even industrial sabotage. And so you may go into this investigating it in order to debunk it and then discover that it's next year's box of bugs that is really going to cause everything to spiral. Or again, as always in Conspiracy Corner, we look to the esoterrorists. This is something that an esoterrorist cell could be ginning up or hyping when somebody else makes it up in order to increase that fear. So they could start taking out their own bug boxes and leaving them around. And as they accumulate more magical power around that, they can do the only thing magic does for you in that particular horror mythos, which is summon outer dark entities. So eventually the bugs from the horror demon realm start to emerge through those boxes. And it's your job to find out who's spreading these things before even bigger and scarier monsters get out there.
And since you've brought up vampires, we have the bug vampire, the Adja, in Night's Black Agents. Maybe there's an enormous Adja or tick vampire, and when he spreads his progeny, his spawn, everyone they bite is now part of his brain web, and he can jump around between their consciousness and see through their eyes and manipulate them. And this is just a big mass recruitment program because he wants to expand into Ontario from his previous home in Michigan or Iowa or wherever he's been feasting on tick-bearing tourists. And now he's moving across the Great Lakes, and only you, brave Canadian burned spies, can stop him.
Well, now that we've got Canadian spies on the case, it's time for us to confidently leave you listeners knowing that you are safe, at least until next week when we come back to create more sinister thoughts to creep into your cerebellums. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pellegrine Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Don't make this podcast sell its books. Chip in alongside such backers as
Ben A,
Brian Orban,
Dave Stecco,
Jacob Boersma,
and Ruth Tillman.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.